Thank you. Be seated.
One or more members of the court may slip out a minute or two early. All nine members of the court will participate in the deliberations and decisions of this cause, however. The court is ready. In this cause, we have allotted 15 minutes for petitioners and respondents to present oral argument. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners.
May it please the court, Mr. Farrell, is now arguing for the petitioner. Petitioner reserves 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, good morning, Your Honors. I am Michael Farrell. I, along with Mr. Keltner, represent the Texaco defendants in this case. Your Honors, approximately 200 years ago, when Congress in the Judiciary Act of 1789 created the federal judicial system, it, in accordance with the U.S. Constitution, ceded exclusive jurisdiction to federal and maritime matters to the district courts of the United States. However, in virtually the same breath, the Congress recognized that state courts are fully competent to adjudicate cases in the maritime area, and also to preserve certain common law remedies, most importantly the right to trial by jury. They enacted the Savings to Suitors Clause, which allows a litigant to bring a maritime case in state court and obtain a trial by jury. This, Your Honors, is a maritime court case.
Counsel?
Yes, sir.
Why did Texaco never plead maritime law?
Your Honor, it's our basic position that the plaintiffs brought this suit in Jefferson County on alternative causes of action, that they brought it under facts that would support a state wrongful death cause of action if proved at trial, as well as brought it by the language of the Third Amended Petition, which was filed merely a month before trial. Facts that would support a maritime cause of action. This is shown in paragraph 3 of their third amended petition, which was the live petition at trial, wherein they specifically state, in addition, plaintiffs allege that the decedent was a Jones Act seaman and is entitled to recover not only for violation of the Jones Act, but also general maritime law. This is something, Your Honors, that will be found in neither of the Beaumont Court of Appeals opinions. This was ignored by the Beaumont Court of Appeals. When this has been raised by us, the only responses given by the plaintiffs is that this is in a paragraph which talks primarily about Farmer Boys, which was a co-defendant. But Your Honors will note that whereas there are specific notations to Farmer Boys in most of those sentences and talking about simple negligence, that the final sentence is a general allegation.
Even so, counsel, Texaco never objected to the admission of evidence that would be irrelevant or not admissible under maritime law. Sort of laid behind the log and let them put on their case, and never objected, never asserted any of the maritime defenses at any point in the trial court.
That's correct, Your Honor. However, Your Honor, I feel that you have to look at this in the nature of the pleadings before the court when the evidence was being introduced, that at that time they still could have proved a state law cause of action or a maritime cause of action or both, for that matter, and then receive the benefit of the most beneficial cause of action proved. This would require an objection that would have to be overruled. I think in our briefs we've set forth the example of the type of objection that would have to be made, that we would be required to stand up and tell the trial judge that we recognize that there are alternative causes of action, and this evidence may support one if eventually proved, but not another. That would be properly overruled, Your Honor.
I assume for purposes of argument that we were not obligated to assert the maritime defenses. As I read Christie against Ruby, Justice Marshall's opinion, the interest giving rise to maritime jurisdiction is protection of maritime commerce. And in there, Justice Marshall sets out a two-part test. One is that the incident itself, the incident that occurs, injury, if you will, whether it's damage to property or person, is likely to disrupt commercial activity, maritime commercial activity. The other is that the activity being engaged in when the injury occurs should have, there should be some substantial relationship between that activity giving rise to the incident, the injury, and traditional maritime activity. Here, navigation.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Texaco shippers navigate in navigable waters. So, meets the second part of the test. Could you please explain to me, before maritime law can be invoked in this case, how the incident itself, that is the crushing of this gentleman against the dock, is likely to disrupt commercial activity?
Yes, Your Honor. The crushing itself is the result. We feel that Sisson also indicates that you should look at the entire scenario in which the situation arose. Therefore, the navigation of the vessel being the gravamen of their complaint, that was the potential impact on maritime commerce, which then provides the nexus requirement for maritime jurisdiction.
Now you're moving over to Justice Scalia's concurrence, which says it's really only one test. Now that the majority Supreme Court clearly said that there was a two-part test. I'm not talking about Justice Scalia's one-part test. Hey, it happened on the water. It's subject to maritime law. There were two other cases that the Supreme Court dealt with this issue that were both cited repeatedly and referred to repeatedly in the system. One was the executive jet case, where a jet crashed into the water. And they said that this did not invoke maritime law, while jets crashing into navigable waters would clearly disrupt maritime activity, commercial activity. That it's not something that is a normal or ordinary traditional maritime activity. On the other hand, and foremost, where a ship burned at the dock, they said docking a ship is a normal maritime activity. But it also, when one burns, could be disrupting to maritime commercial activity. Here, the incident itself, it's very difficult for me to grasp how the incident itself, that is, the crushing of this guy between the dock and a dock boat at the pier on the land, could be disruptive of maritime commercial activity. No question about Texaco shipping. It involved ordinary navigation, ordinary maritime activity. How could his crushing on land be disruptive of commercial maritime activity?
Your Honor, I feel that it can, and I would disagree with Your Honor that it can't.
Well, I'm asking for you to explain to me how it can.
It can because you're talking about a commercial fishing area or marina. An accident such as this, number one, interferes potentially, which is very important in the Sisson opinion, with the commercial activity at the dock, with the commercial activity of the boat, the shrimp boat that was involved, indeed the activity of the decedent, because he was fouling or removing a line which had fouled the propeller of the shrimp boat. And I think it's very important, Your Honor, in Sisson, they spoke not just, they instructed us not to be fact specific, not to look at the specific facts of the case and see whether, in fact, commercial activity was interfered with, but instead look at the potential. Indeed, in Sisson itself, they held that this fire may not have disrupted the activities at the marina at which the fire occurred, but it had the potential. And that was the hazard that they spoke of And I think, Your Honor, that the hazard they were speaking of was the executive jet's second prong of the test of bearing a significant relationship to a traditional maritime activity, and they were looking at the hazard to see how it fit into significance. Have I fully responded to you, Your Honor?
I guess you have. I'm not sure it's not circular, but go on.
What is the closest case that you think supports your position factually?
Factually, in terms of the lack of ability for state law damages to supplant or to supplement general maritime law wrongful death damages, I feel, Your Honor, there are four cases. Four circuits. We're not speaking here today on that basic issue, which is the primary issue before the court. We're not speaking here with a blank slate. Four circuits after the Moraine decision in 1970, which is, the court is aware, created the maritime wrongful death cause of action. The Fifth Circuit in Helena involved a death of several Coast Guardsmen, as a matter of fact, which I think is the closest to our case, because the plaintiffs have made an issue in this case that the decedent was not a seaman. For some reason, the term seaman has become very magical in this case and forgotten in the discussion is the fact that there is a general maritime negligence cause of action which does not require a person to be a seaman or a longshoreman or anybody such as that. It merely requires that person to be injured or killed in a maritime context. The Helena case is very important for a variety of reasons. One, it was the Fifth Circuit, one of the preeminent maritime circuits in the land. Second, it was Judge Wisdom, one of the preeminent maritime jurists in this century. And third, it involved the deaths of Coast Guard personnel.
Counsel, I think that the question was to name the cases and not give the...
Oh, okay, sir.
...their pure surroundings, given that your time has expired. So if you could just run through
sure.
the others, and if Judge Heck has a follow-up question, that would be fine.
Your Honor, there are three other cases, the Sixth Circuit in U.S. Steel, the Nelson case in the Ninth Circuit, as well as the Lyons case in the First Circuit, have all held precisely on the issue presented in this case, held in our, to adhere to our position.
If you're correct, does this judgment need to be remanded for a new trial, or does it only affect the damages award?
It only affects the damages, Your Honor. We
and
feel...
And how does it affect them?
It affects them in terms of the mental anguish. There were $575,000 awarded in mental anguish, less 15% for contributory negligence. Mental anguish damages are not awardable under the Maritime Wrongful Death Cause of Action. Those should be done away with. We also feel that the $575,000, less 15%, awarded for loss of society is now severely at issue in view of the Miles v. Apex Marine case, which was decided last fall by the Supreme Court, which held that loss of society in a seaman's case, which this admittedly does not precisely concern, in view of uniformity and trying to bring the cases back or the damages in all wrongful deaths back to the Jones Act and the Death on the High Seas Act, loss of society should not be allowed. We feel that's a beacon that in the future, and indeed this court, in view of the Godet decision, which left it to the lower courts to sift through the damages, that the $575,000, that's 15% for loss of society, should also be remitted.
But as far as the trial of the case is concerned, your position does not impinge upon that, I think.
No, sir. No,
and
sir.
Therefore, now that you've been up to the Supreme Court once, the United States Supreme Court, and you're making your trek again through the appellate courts, if we should agree with you, the correct judgment in this case could be rendered as a matter of law.
That's correct, Your Honor. And one other, if I might mention, the prejudgment interest is also at issue, because it's our position that in a savings to suitors case such as this, that is brought in a state court or on the law side of a federal court, prejudgment interest is not allowed.
Any other questions? The court is ready to hear argument from Ms. Thomas.
Thank you.
Please, the court, Mr. Slodgett, will present argument.
It's please the court, my name is George Slogic, arguing for the respondent in this case. I would like to point out one thing to the court. When this case was first tried and appealed, the petitioners in this case only complained about the awarding of mental anguish damages. And that's the only issue, other than the preemption argument they're making today, that was before the court at the lower level and before the appellate courts. They have now injected in here an additional 2 points, which have never been passed on by the lower courts, the first time here, about the recovery of prejudgment interest and the recovery of loss of society. That has never been in anything before. I've asked the court to reject the argument.
With respect to the loss of society argument, I understand their position simply that the law may have changed. They don't really say the law has changed, but it may be changing.
Yes, sir.
And if that's true, if the law has changed.
If the law has changed about.
Shouldn't they be entitled to take advantage of it, even though they didn't raise it below?
That may, yes, sir. It would depend upon whether or not there has been a total preemption by the maritime law over the state Texas Wrongful Death Act. In this particular case, this man was not a seaman. He was not a longshoreman. He was not a member of the crew. He was not a passenger on a vessel. The facts show that he was probably a volunteer. He was trying to help this captain take the...
I'm sorry, probably. Is there any doubt?
Yes, sir. I think it was shown in the trial court that he was just a volunteer helping remove a net. He was climbing up the side, and this wave hit him and crushed him. And when the parents brought the suit, bear in mind he was not there to tell anyone what he was doing. So, as a matter of fact, this case started out in the federal court and was dismissed by the plaintiffs and brought in the state court. And if you'll look at the paragraph before what the petitioners have brought you here, they brought a suit against Texaco strictly under the theory of negligence. Because he had been on this vessel and working on this dock and no one knew for sure exactly what he was doing, in their pleadings they brought it strictly against Farmer's Boy under the maritime law, not knowing exactly what his position was, and the evidence in the court showed he was not a seaman, and that case did not develop against Farmer's Boy at all. But as I understand it, there are 2 points here, that there's been a total preemption and the problem of whether or not they must specifically plead the maritime law in the lower court, or they've waived it, looking at your recent decisions in the Gorman under ERISA. I'm going to argue those 2 points together because I think they're so intertwined that it would be difficult to separate one from the other.
Counsel, let me ask you one question before you get started on that tack. If the Court of Appeals is right in this case, why did the United States Supreme Court grant cert on it and then remand it to be considered in light of the Solomon or Sisson case, however that's properly pronounced?
Yes, sir. I did not handle this case in the court below, but when I saw that come back to the United States Supreme Court, 2 things hit me. One, I disagreed with the Court of Appeals that this was not a maritime tort, and I wasn't there to argue that part of it. But the most significant thing that I saw when they sent that case back and cited Ruby versus Sisson is this. They had the issue before them of whether or not maritime law preempted the Texas Wrongful Death Act, and they didn't act on it at all. What they did was said this. They said, you're not correct in saying this is not a maritime tort, because it is. And my position would be, just as Mr. Farrell mentioned, you have the right under the facts of this case to go under either the maritime law or the Texas Wrongful Death Act, whichever one is going to be most favorable to you. Let's say you have a situation like this, that you have a territorial water situation, and you have an unseaworthiness claim. You don't have a good negligence claim. Under the cases of the United States Supreme Court, you can go and find unseaworthiness and file an admiralty claim if you want to, if you feel like that's your best bet. Let's take another situation. In admiralty law, they don't have the harsh rule of 51% negligence. And let's say you have a situation where someone is killed and the plaintiff feels like you've got a tough row to hoe as far as your own negligence is concerned or the decedent's negligence. He would then, I think, be inclined to go under the maritime law, and that harsh rule goes away.
So your view is that under Sisson, this is a maritime tort.
No question this is a maritime tort. But if you'll read... Yes, I don't disagree with that it's a maritime tort. What I do disagree with is that the United States Supreme Court, in its holdings in previous cases, and I disagree that the statutes that they've passed concerning maritime preempts the Texas wrongful death statute. You read the Moraine case. Well, let's just look at what really is the crux of it. The Death on the High Seas Act came around in 1920 because there was no cause of action for death on the high seas. The Harrisburg case said, which was an old maritime law case under the general rules of admiralty, there was no cause of action for death on the high seas or anywhere. So the legislature came along and had the Death on the High Seas Act. They also did the Jones Act, which is specifically for seamen. They come along later, they passed the Longshoremen and Harbor Workers Act. What for? Because the workers' comp laws in the states weren't covering people doing that kind of activity. When they were going on offshore platforms, they came off of the Outer Continental Shelf Act. I'm sure you'll all know that. But when they did the Death on the High Seas Act, they said this act only applies one marine league from shore, which means that it's not in state territorial waters more than 3 miles from shore. Why did they do that? Because they fully intended to leave to the states their own laws concerning wrongful death and other activity in navigable waters. If the United States Congress intended for you to not have any rights in the navigable waters of Texas, why didn't they call it the Death on the Navigable Waters Act instead of the Death on the High Seas Act and not put it one marine league? It doesn't make any sense. There's never been a case in the United States Supreme Court, and I'm not interested really in what the lower courts say because that's the last word. There's never been a case that has held that where you have a death or an injury on navigable waters within a state that you cannot recover under state law. There is no case holding that.
Is it your contention that your third amended original petition invoked both Texas state law wrongful death damages recovery as well as maritime law?
Your Honor, I really don't know how to answer. My personal feeling is that the plaintiff had the right to proceed under either one.
Okay.
In other words, I don't think there's any...
My question, though, relates to the pleading. Does the plaintiff's third amended original petition, part of which is displayed here, invoke potential recovery under both Texas wrongful death general maritime law?
No, sir. He didn't intend to do that, apparently. He could have, I say, but I don't think he did. I think he intentionally went against Texaco strictly under the Wrongful Death Act.
What about the highlighted portion here, which invokes the general maritime law?
That's strictly a paragraph relating to Farmer Boy's Catfish Kitchen, which was the owner of the dock and possibly that vessel there. I don't think
we should treat this petition as if that does not, those words do not exist.
Judge, it's hard for me to say because that does allege that, but it's in a separate paragraph, and I don't know how you, if you want to say any time you plead in a pleading as to one defendant, you plead as to all the defendants, then that would be the case. In this particular case, if they had wanted to bring Texaco under the maritime law, the person who filed these pleadings certainly knows how to plead. He would have said, I'm proceeding against you on the theory of negligence, and I'm also under the Texas law, and I'm also proceeding under general maritime law, and put it in the same paragraph. He didn't.
Is it your contention that this pleading invokes general maritime law only insofar as the defendant Farmer's Boy is concerned?
That was the intention, and that's the way I would read it, yes, sir.
I will say this, that I think that you have the right to do both if that's what you intend to do, and you tell the court in advance, I'm going under both theories. Whichever one is the better theory for my client is the one that I will proceed on. There's nothing mysterious about that approach because of the fact that the many plaintiffs today would be remiss if they didn't plead against the defendant RICO, recoveries under the federal laws, recoveries under the state laws, and I think they have the right. The one thing that
RICO is exclusive federal court jurisdiction now.
I'm sorry.
RICO can only be pled in a federal court.
Yes, I'm sorry. But what I'm saying is that you still have the right in the federal court under certain circumstances, you can plead different theories and recover under the ones that you feel is the best for your client on the recovery. Here, in this particular situation, I wanted to read you some of the language that militates against any holding by this court that this was an exclusive remedy under the maritime law. The language in the Moraine case points out very specifically that the states were reserved the right to handle best in their own territorial waters. Let me tell you one thing to think about in this particular instance, and see if you think this applies, because Justice over here was pointing it out. If a child is standing in 1 inch of water in Lake Travis, a navigable waterway, and a motorboat comes along and washes that child into the water and drowns it, it is the contention of Texaco that is a maritime tort, and that you don't have any remedy under the Texas wrongful death statute.
Do you agree with the first part?
Sir?
Do you agree that it's maritime tort?
Yes, sir.
It's just the second part that you disagree.
If the parents of that child felt that they had a better cause of action under maritime law, look at Foremost Insurance versus Richardson. That was two motorboats running together in Louisiana. And the question came up, well, we've never had this. It's commercial activity. And the Supreme Court of the United States held, we're going to do away with commercial activity. Two motorboats, if they want to recover under general maritime law, they're welcome to do it. I have no doubt, had they pled it in the alternative in the courts in Louisiana, that the United States Supreme Court said, yes, you can go under this law or you can go under the maritime law.
Maritime law
is no problem with that.
You're arguing then that the Foremost merely allows the litigants to proceed under maritime law. It doesn't require them to.
It didn't require them to do that. They elected to do that.
What's the distinction between this case and Helena, USB, Nelson, and Lyon?
I'm sorry.
The distinction between this case and the four circuit cases cited by petition.
Judge, I didn't really pay a lot of attention to the circuit cases because I felt that the Supreme Court of the United States cases spoke so strongly on it that it would be difficult for me to argue those cases because those cases have never been passed on. I read the Moraine case in which, not a similar situation, but one in which the question came up of whether or not you could recover under maritime law for the for wrongful death in territorial waters. And they came forward and said, yes, you can, we overruled the Harrisburg. But when they did that, they spent a lot of time in pointing out the legislative history of Moraine and that they reserved to the states the right to regulate their own laws with regard to wrongful death and that they did not intend to usurp the laws of the state and take it over. That would have been an excellent case for them to hold if they wanted to. Although I think it possibly was dictum if they did, that it was completely taken over by the maritime jurisdiction and that you had no right or cause of action under the laws. Look at the Tungus case. That was one where a fellow fell into the hold of a ship. He wasn't a longshoreman, wasn't a seaman. And in the Tungus case, he sued for unseaworthiness as well as negligence. And the court had difficulty with that because it wasn't considered to be recoverable for a non-seaman, non-longshoreman to recover for under seaworthiness under the general maritime law. So what the court did was they went down and found out whether or not, in that particular case, was the laws of New Jersey, whether or not New Jersey would allow a recovery for unseaworthiness under their wrongful death statute. And when they came to that conclusion, they said, well, you can recover too. So they got him, had him on the admiralty side here and had him on the law side over here. But in any event, they allowed recovery.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear rebuttal argument.
Farrell, would you please tell us why federal law is preempted?
Your Honor, there are two primary reasons, one of which is, and probably the most important of which, is uniformity. But in footnote 12 in the Moraine decision, the Supreme Court held and found that uniformity of maritime law, so that it will apply throughout the United States in a consistent and uniform manner, is not simply something that the court had concocted, but is constitutionally mandated. That it was a decision made when our Constitution was ratified, was drafted and ratified, that it was recognized that interstate maritime activity is something that impacts on many states and therefore would be left to the federal government. The second reason is because of the gap-filling aspect that state law has normally and still assists in the application of maritime law, that where maritime law does not speak to something, then state law can be used to fill that gap. But once there's an impact between the state law and maritime law, then it has to fall to the principle of uniformity.
You're making a new distinction, that is, between interstate and intrastate navigation activities.
That is not a distinction I'm making anew, Your Honor. I would make
first
that
first time it's come up.
Okay, that is what is reserved in the Constitution is the navigable waters of the United States, which has been defined as meaning waters that are navigable between and amongst the various states. That there, if there is a landlocked lake, a landlocked river, landlocked, a state locked within one state, then I think it's clear that that doesn't fall under the constitutional admiralty and maritime clause.
Lake Travis is what he said wouldn't be true, but if it was Rayburn Lake, it would be true.
That, I'm not so certain that Lake Travis wouldn't be true as well, Your Honor, that the courts would look at the Colorado River and determine whether at the point of Lake Travis it was of a part of a waterway that would be a path of commerce between Texas and any other state or any foreign country.
Well, you know, eventually gets to the Gulf of Mexico, but it starts in Colorado City, Texas.
Yes, sir.
But Rayburn Lake, there's no question about it, it abuts on both Texas and Louisiana.
That's correct, Your Honor. That too.
You're saying if the little girl was standing on the shore of Lake Travis, it's conceivable that if a motorboat washed her into the lake and she drowned, that they could only recover under maritime law. They couldn't recover under the Texas Wrongful Death Act.
I think it's conceivable that they could only recover under maritime law, and it's conceivable that they could only recover or could recover under state. Even though Sisson has taught us not to be fact-intensive, the executive jet test is still very factual, and I don't feel you can make a flat statement, yes or no, that you would still have to look at whether it bore a significant relationship.
Well, you have to examine the facts under Sisson.
Yes, sir.
You have to determine whether that, under as it was articulated by Justice Marshall in a concurrent by a majority of the court, you have to determine whether the incident itself posed a danger to commerce. Let's see, what were the exact words? Disrupt commercial activity. It's likely to disrupt commercial activity. Whether that incident itself, you have to be fact-intensive to that degree. Now, obviously, a little girl being washed in Lake Travis by the wake of some guy out there in a motorboat is not calculated to disrupt commercial activity. So you would say that maritime law did not apply. Still haven't explained my satisfaction why a guy being crushed between the dock and a dock boat by the wake of Texaco's ship is likely to disrupt commercial activity, even if, as you argue, federal law is preempted?
Your Honor, I cannot read Sasan that narrowly fact-intensive. I have to read Sasan.
Well, that's what Justice Scalia said, but the majority did read it that narrowly fact-intensive.
No, Your Honor, I think Justice Scalia was saying as long as it happens on the water, that's enough for me. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying, Your Honor, is that you can't ignore in our case that what is being complained of is the activities and the navigation of the Texaco California. So that could be disruptive to maritime commerce, because what the trial judge said here was you travel too fast. That in and of itself has a potential, and that is critical, Your Honor, because as you read it, likely to have or a potential of having an impact on maritime commerce.
Well, since respondent concedes that point, do you agree that the Supreme Court had never addressed the preemptive nature of maritime law apart from your argument regards Moraine footnote 12?
In terms of Moraine, that's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
You say the lower court, some of the lower courts have.
Yes, sir. Every lower court that's spoken to it has come down on our side, Your Honor.
And regards the Gorman preemption question about jurisdictional type preemption as opposed to choice of law preemption, there's no question in this case that the action was properly brought in the state district court in any event.
That's correct, Your Honor, but I feel that this case fits very neatly into the Gorman inquiry that the court crafted very recently, that you have exclusive maritime jurisdiction and then a jurisdictional ceding of certain of that to the states, much like you have in ERISA. The states then have to act in what's called the reverse Erie fashion and actually act as a maritime court like a federal maritime court sitting in admiralty would. So I think what you do then is, if it's a type of damage in a wrongful death case as we have here, such as mental anguish, that then that becomes jurisdictional. That is the inquiry that is made in Gorman, and we feel that it fits very neatly here. And in that respect, Your Honor, I would like to note that it was mentioned that we did not complain about prejudgment interest below. That is incorrect. In that regard, we feel there's too much emphasis been played here today by the plaintiff's attorneys that it's what was pleaded. You also have to look at what was proved. And when you look at what was pleaded, you have to look also at the paragraph 2, which is the Texaco allegations. And we would quickly, I notice my time is out, refer the court to the El Paso Court of Decisions, Dapiero decision, where you don't have to use the magical words, I am going to go into maritime law. This, Your Honors, could be a maritime cause of action. It could be a state cause of action. Right. It depends on what was proved. Here was a maritime cause of action, and as soon as the judge came out with that judgment, we immediately moved to amend the judgment.
Thank you.
Any further questions? These three cases submitted on the briefing oral arguments, the marshal will adjourn the court.
No,
thank you.
Oye, oye, oye.